This is episode 32 of the Great Speech Podcast on The Tilbury Speech by Queen Elizabeth I, a great speech analysed.
Let's go.
It's a great speech podcast for the public speakers. We're going way down deep to look at what makes a communicator. We'll look at all different topics from the bottom to the top. So get your mind free of all the distractions and please listen up, listen up, listen up.
It's the Great Speech Podcast.
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 Thanks, Dad. Welcome back. Welcome back, my great communicators. How you guys doing? I hope you are well. It is, of course, me, Colarelation IK, back with another episode of the Great Speech Podcast in the year 2021. I know everyone, myself included, hoped, prayed that this was going to be a better year than 2020. But I don't know if it really is shaping up that way. And as one of the best or worst memes I saw last year said, if you thought 2020 was bad, just remember that 2021 was the year in which the movie Mad Max was set. At least the Mel Gibson version, if for all those of you who are old enough to remember that one. So let us pray that it is going to be a better year. And I certainly wish for all of you listening to this great progress and safety and health for you and your families and your loved ones in this year 2021. Now, actually, you probably can't tell this, but I'm going to see anyway. Can you hear anything? Can you hear any background noise or any cars driving past, even though I try to kind of mask those sounds? Well, you shouldn't be able to, because for the first time, I am now recording this episode of this podcast in my new office. I have kind of moved out of the room I was in the house, which was kind of on the top of the house that overlooked the road. So you would sometimes hear trucks or cars driving past, even though I use the noise removal software on my computer to mask it. But I actually now have moved into a garden office and it's so much quieter. Apart from the odd occasional dog barking or fox fighting, or if it rains quite loudly. But apart from that, it's so much quieter and I can make noise without being heard or overheard. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Hopefully the sound quality is even better. Now, this week, let me get back to something that I should always do. And I kind of got away from this, which is to start every episode with a quote. My quote for this week is, "I know I have the body, but of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and the stomach of a king and a king of England too." That quote, of course, is from Elizabeth I, Queen Elizabeth I, and I've chosen it because it is the most famous line in a speech that she gave way back in 1588, popularly known as the Tilbury Speech. And I'll explain why I have chosen to analyze this particular speech in this episode. But before I do that, let me just give a shout out to a gentleman called Stefan, who has done a review of the podcast that says, the subject line is just brilliant, 5 stars. So we already like that start. Thank you very much, Stephen. This podcast is fantastic. Great format. Collar is very eloquently spoken and very intelligent in an entertaining way. Ah, thank you very much, sir. This is one of those podcasts you never want to miss an episode, or you never want an episode to finish. Thank you very much, Stephen. I really appreciate that. As you know, if you give me a review, I will give you a shout out. That is how it works. So thank you for that review, Stephen. Really appreciate it. If you listen to this now, stop what you're doing, scroll down somewhere on Apple Podcast and click write a review, and you will get a shout out in the very next episode, or at least after the one I see it. So what I'm doing this week is to analyze a speech that was given by Queen Elizabeth I, popularly known as the Tilbury Speech. Now, You know, unless you are a purist like me into speeches, you may not know that much about this speech. Possibly you've seen snippets of it in the movie Elizabeth with Kate Blanchett. It's been referenced by people a few times, but it's not necessarily the most famous of the speeches. If you think about, you know, I Have a Dream and Churchill speeches and things like that. But this is really a fantastic speech in my judgment. In fact, on my, I've done an article, I'll put the link in the show notes, so scroll down if you're listening to this, an article of the my top 10 favorite speeches by women. And this speech, the Tilbury speech, is number 2 on that list. And in fact, I did a podcast episode actually about my favorite speeches by women, which really get very, very underappreciated. It's pretty shocking actually. And I had a great episode with Dana Rubin, episode 29. So just a couple of episodes ago in which we talked about speaking and public speaking and speeches by women. So this is one of my favorite speeches. And the reason that I think it is still relevant, why I chose to analyze it, is that it is a fantastic example of leadership and motivational speaking by a leader, if I put it that way. It's interesting, actually, that, of course, Queen Elizabeth I was one of the great sovereigns of England, great women leaders of England. And it's interesting, in an era today when you look around the world and see that it is the countries that are led by women that have done the best in the pandemic, you know, places like New Zealand with Jacinda Ardern and Germany with Angela Merkel and Taiwan with Tsai Ing-wen, I think it is. It's interesting to get this perspective on leadership and female leadership, but way back in a time where there really was very little appreciation for female sovereigns. So Queen Elizabeth I, of course, was the daughter of Henry VIII, but she was the daughter of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, who was, of course, the wife of Henry VIII, who he executed or beheaded. Or at least one of them that he executed. I think he executed a couple of others. And so, although she, by the time she gave this speech, the Tilbury speech, she was the Queen of England, she had had to fight her way to that. So Henry VIII had declared her illegitimate, which meant that she was not, in many people's eyes, seen as the rightful heir and the rightful queen of the country. On top of that, you had at this time huge battles between Protestants and Catholics. And there really was a total division between those who were Protestants and those who were Catholics. You know, often Protestants were considered heretics, and people were burnt at the stake and all that sort of thing. So at the time that this speech was being given, it was in the context where King Philip of Spain basically was looking to invade England because he essentially was supporting the other lady at the time, the Mary Queen of Scots, who Elizabeth had executed. And Philip II, I think, of Spain, was using that as an excuse to invade the country effectively. So at the time this speech was given, Queen Elizabeth I had a hugely divided country. Her leadership of that country was definitely in doubt and was being threatened. And she was being invaded by a very, very powerful enemy. And she was a woman leader at war, which, of course, at that time, people thought only primarily of men and kings being warrior leaders. So you can imagine how much really hung on this speech. And basically, so Tilbury is an area in Essex, in London. And this is where her troops were marshaled. There were about 8,000 English troops. And at that time, it was believed that the Spanish who they believed were on the brink of invading had about 19,000 troops. So kind of 2-to-1 effectively. Now, when this speech was given, as it happened, the Spanish had already decided to go home. So although there was the threat of invasion, in truth, it didn't in fact materialize. But Elizabeth wasn't to know that at the time she gave this speech. And when she gave this speech, she really was having to gee up her troops and motivate them ready for a battle in which they looked completely outnumbered. And that was going to threaten her leadership, her sovereignty, and of course, the course of history of the country. So a lot riding on this, of course. And when she gives this speech in 1558, she what's quite interesting is, and that's why I say I really liked it as an example of leadership, is that she really thought about the whole package of it. So Elizabeth was fiercely intelligent, a leader. She wrote a lot of her own speeches. She wrote poetry as well. And when she gave this speech to her troops, she really thought about how she would have to deliver this in order to motivate her troops. So she didn't just rock up and start speaking. She was dressed in a silver body armor, effectively riding on a kind of gray semi-white horse with a plumed helmet, white velvet gown, a silver truncheon. She had the sword of state, which is kind of the symbol of the power and might of the country, that was carried by one of her earls. And then another earl was kind of holding a horse's bridle as she strutted in front of her soldiers. So you can imagine this pretty powerful image of this queen with her flowing red hair standing in front of or riding in front of the troops, addressing them on the eve of battle. So what I like about that is that she's already thought about not just the words that she's going to use, but the impression that she must create in the minds of her soldiers. And that's part of the reason why I like this speech, in that I think a lot of people, when they speak, don't think about essentially the drama of what they're going to say and how they're going to say it. Too often, and I have this with clients as well that I coach, they think that it is the logic of what they say that will do the work. And when it comes to leadership, you really are not just about making a coherent argument. It really has to be about winning hearts and minds. And Elizabeth really understood the importance of doing this. So let's look at the speech itself. Now, what's a bit of a shame in this one? It's a real shame, is that there's no real decent recording of this speech. Even in the movie Elizabeth, in which Kate Blanchett gives a really good performance, actually in the part where she delivers this speech, the speechwriters are kind of taken poetic license and written words that weren't really fully reflective of the wonderful speech that she actually gave to her soldiers. Now, I say the wonderful speech she actually gave. Interestingly, when I was doing research for this speech, there are actually kind of three versions of this speech that are recorded. The one that is most known, and the one that certainly I'm going to be assessing, is one that was kind of written about at the time by a chaplain writing to one of the Queen's courtiers, the Duke of Buckingham. And that's the one that kind of famously is most known. But there are kind of two or three versions of the speech that have circulated, even though this, the one I'm going to review, is the one that's best known. So I will have to do my reading for you, because there is no reading or video or audio that I can kind of crib a little bit of to analyze in the way that I've done with other speeches. So forgive me. I'm not going to do it in the voice of Elizabeth. It's just going to be my voice. So how does she start? So as I said, she's already come in with a really powerful image, you know, riding on a white horse in silver body armor with the, you know, the sword and everything in front of her. And she starts with this: "My loving people, we have been persuaded by some that are careful of our safety to take heed how we commit ourselves to armed multitudes for fear of treachery. But I assure you, I do not desire to live to distrust my faithful and loving people." So why is that such a great opening? So the first thing, and it's something again that I always share with my clients, is she just launches into the speech, right? There's no preamble. There's no, you know, hey, everybody, I'm here. You know, sorry, I'm late or whatever it is. You know, it's just let's start speaking. And I often emphasize that to people is audiences, when you're giving a speech, for instance, don't need and don't kind of care for the preamble of, you know, oh, I'm sorry, I'm a bit nervous, that kind of thing, or the apologies beforehand. They just want to hear what you have to say. And Elizabeth does that. She simply launches into the speech itself. And when she starts with my loving people, what I like about that is, if you think about it at the time, she is the sovereign and her people she rules over. And so by saying my loving people, she's really saying that I'm going to endear myself to you. I love you and I know you love me. Now, you might say it's a little bit arrogant, but you can excuse that. She is the queen after all, right? But it's kind of saying we are one, we are together. You are my people whom I care for. And when she says that we've been persuaded by some people to be careful of our safety and take heed how we commit ourselves to multitudes of people effectively for fear of treachery, that was a very real concern. Of course, at that time, again, if you've seen the movies, there are lots of spies in the court. There was a very, very real risk that she would be assassinated. There had been assassination attempts. It was kind of the thing of the day at that time. You know, people getting stabbed, poisoned, thrown off, you know, roofs and things like that. So her riding in amongst her troops or riding out and about really was a risk. But again, that's why I like it, because as a leader, you know that there are times when you have to show yourself. You can't be aloof somewhere and send down word, you know, through your underlings. You have to be there with your people, showing that notwithstanding the risks, you are there with them and for them. And that's why she says, but I assure you, I do not desire to live to distrust my faithful and loving people. Again, she repeats that phrase, loving people, and says, I don't care even if there's a risk. I would rather kind of take that risk than distrust those people, the people that I love. And what that's saying is, I commit myself to you. I open myself to you. I'm willing to be vulnerable with you because I love you so much. You know, again, it's just such a powerful opening. And this whole speech is very, very short. It's really basically about 310 or so words, and probably will have taken her 1 or 2 minutes, maybe two or three minutes to deliver. So think about that, right? This is on the eve of the invasion of your country. How much time do you want to spend speaking? Most people would think, oh, I got to stall for, you know, 20 minutes to really G them up. And she spends 2 or 3 minutes doing it and doing it very effectively. So she goes on. Let tyrants fear. I have always so behaved myself that under God I have placed my chiefest strength and safeguard in the loyal hearts and goodwill of my subjects. And again, she's saying, yes, other people might be scared to walk amongst their people, but that's tyrants. And by saying let tyrants fear, she's saying I don't fear because I'm not a tyrant. Some may argue with that, of course, but the point is she's kind of positioning herself as a woman, a sovereign of the people. And that's exactly where you want to be, where what you're about to ask of those people is that they give their lives for you. So it's very smart, very clever approach to motivational speaking, which is to really connect with your audience. And so she goes on, and therefore I'm come amongst you as you see at this time, not for my recreation and disport, but being resolved in the midst and heat of the battle to live and die amongst you all, to lay down for my God and for my kingdom and my people, my honor and blood, even in the dust. So now it's very ornate language, right? Because it was of the time. But again, what she's saying is, look, I'm not here to play games, right? I'm here. I'm resolved. And in the midst, in the heat of battle, I'm going to live and die amongst you all. It's really emotive stuff. And of course, when you are trying to G up your troops to go into battle for you, you have to connect with them deeply, right? It has to resonate. And what she's doing is saying, I am with you. I'm prepared to live and die amongst you. And of course, that's very relevant because she is a woman. And in many of the soldiers' eyes, maybe before, until they heard this, she would have no idea about battle. She wouldn't know what that's really like. And she certainly wouldn't be prepared to give her own life in the fight. But here she's saying, no, don't be fooled by the fact that I'm a woman. I'm going to live and die amongst you all. And she says to lay down for my God and for my kingdom and my people. So she uses very, very effective technique called the rule of three, which is basically whenever you're saying anything, if you can put it in threes to summarize the reasons or, you know, the thoughts that you have, it just works. Psychologically, we are kind of wired to appreciate things being put in threes, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, that kind of thing. So where she says, she's going to lay down my life for my God, for my country, and my people, that's again just using that lyrical technique to connect with the hearts and minds of her soldiers. And so she goes on, and this is where we come to the most famous line of the speech. And it's just such a good line. It was the opening quote for this episode. She says, I know I have the body, but of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and a king of England too. So, you know, I know you guys are thinking, wow, Colin, you're really geeking out on this stuff, right? But this is such good leadership. It is. So what she does here is she plays on her perceived weakness, right? She is but a woman, but a woman with the weak and feeble body of a woman. So she plays on that. You know, many people would try to ignore it or to pretend like it's not there. That would be the usual instinct of many leaders. But the thing is that it is not the weakness, or in this case, the perceived weakness, that is the issue. Everybody has weaknesses. Everybody has perceived weaknesses. Everybody has things that are not considered strengths, right? If you try and act like that doesn't exist, people in the back of their minds will be thinking about it. And so because they're thinking about it, but you're not addressing it, it will undermine what it is you're trying to say, because you'll be trying to project strength, but they'll just be thinking about your weaknesses. So instead of just trying to hide or pretend that weakness, that perceived weakness, isn't there, what she does instead is lean into it. She says, oh yes, I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, right? You know, which some of them are probably thinking, yeah, what's this, you know, just a woman, you don't know anything about battle. Right. But she said, but I have the heart and stomach of a king. That is saying it doesn't matter about my body. The issue is heart. And what's good about that is all the soldiers will recognize that immediately, because they will know even amongst themselves that there's some people who are, you know, great, you know, physical specimens, right, as it were. But in battle, they don't quite have the same heart as somebody who isn't as strong as them. They'll recognize that. So when she says, yeah, okay, my body might not be as strong as yours, but my heart is strong. It's the heart and stomach of a king. And then she goes further and says, and a king of England too. That is really, really taking it to the level. It's such a great line. And oh, see now. So, you know, I do my recording in one take. There's some sort of dog barking. I don't know if you can hear that or not. I'm going to soldier on. But it's such a great line. So, you know, again, just I'm going to write out the entire speech in the show notes. So just scroll down and have a read of it. But that's such a good line. But it's so instructive of how to properly address your weaknesses. Don't pretend they don't exist. Show how you overcome them. I was actually talking about this recently with my daughter, who is in the middle of the stress and hassle of 11 plus exams and interviews. And we had to talk about how you deal with that typical question of, you know, oh, what are you weak at, or what are your weaknesses, which I sometimes is asked of, you know, gosh, how do you ask that of an 11-year-old girl, which is unbelievable. But sometimes it's asked. And what people often try and do, and you'll get this in interviews and things like that, what people often try and do is give kind of a false weakness, right? Oh, my attention to detail is too great, right? Yeah. I've got too much attention to detail. I'm too picky. I'm too hard on myself, you know, that kind of thing. It's kind of a faux weakness because you're saying it's not really a weakness. Can you hear that dog? Oh dear, it's terrible. See, I thought being here was going to be so quiet, and now I've got to deal with all the dogs. So it's kind of like a false weakness, right? But instead of doing that, where everybody knows you're not really being honest about your weaknesses, the thing to do is actually to admit to a real and genuine weakness, but also, oh, this dog, but also show how you are going to overcome it. Show what work you are doing to overcome that weakness. That's the key. That's what allows you to be open and frank about your weaknesses, because you're going to follow it up with, and this is what I'm doing about it. And that way it turns a weakness into a strength, because it shows that you're the kind of person who will work on your weaknesses, not pretend that you don't have any. So this is basically what Elizabeth does here. She gives in to the kind of the stereotype that she knows the soldiers will have, but then she flips it and makes it a strength. Brilliant, brilliant stuff. Anyway, let's carry on. And so she goes, and think foul scorn that Parma, or Spain, or any prince of Europe should dare to invade the borders of my realm, to which rather than any dishonor shall grow by me, I myself will take up arms. I myself will be your general judge, rewarder of every one of your virtues in the field. So now, maybe a bit tricky language. I had to read it a couple of times to really understand what she was saying here. So essentially what she's saying is that if anyone, so Parma there is the references to the Duke of Parma and to Spain, who were the Spanish Armada. So if any foreigners, essentially she's saying, should dare to invade this country, rather than allow myself to be dishonored, I myself will take up arms. So there she's saying, rather than being dishonored. Now, dishonored there, I think, has a double meaning. On the one hand, it's the dishonor of having your country being invaded when you are the sovereign. But on the other, I think she's also playing on the fact that she is a woman. Because, of course, in war, soldiers would often dishonor women, obviously by, you know, hey, what you know, right? And again, I think this is so clever, because what she's doing there is, again, using the fact that she's a woman to really tug at the heartstrings of her soldiers. Because you can imagine that this gives an added dimension to the reason they're going to fight, which is, we are not going to let these Spanish invaders come here and dishonor our queen. Really, really smart stuff. Really smart stuff. So where she also says, I will myself take up arms, that's repeating the point that she's made about, I'm going to be willing to fight for you. And then where she says to you, to be your, I myself will be your general judge and rewarder of every one of your virtues in the field. She's doing a few things there. She's saying, I will be your general, which is, I'm going to be the leader. So I'm going to be there fighting with you, even though she actually wasn't going to be, but it's still important motivationally. She says, I'll be your judge, which is, now again, this is good. This is leadership of the time, right? Because it's basically saying, hey, also, if you don't fight, I'm going to be your judge. You know, I'm going to be the one essentially court-martialing you. You don't fight. In those days, you could be executed if you don't actually fight with your fellow soldiers. So I'll be your judge if you fight poorly. She also says, I'll be your rewarder of every one of your virtues. So if you fight well, I'm also going to reward you. And, you know, in that time, as a soldier, reward from, if a sovereign promises a reward, that's obviously a massive, massive deal. So again, it's using every element of motivation in this. She's motivating you by saying, don't let the foreigners invade our country, to kind of tug on the patriotism heartstrings of her soldiers. She's saying, don't let them dishonor me as a woman, to tug on the kind of the macho protective elements in her male soldiers. She's saying, I will be your general, which means I'm going to fight with you, which tugs on that heartstring. I'll be your judge if you don't fight, which kind of gives them a bit of a kick up the butt if they were slacking a bit, but I'll reward you as well. So she's appealing to their kind of those people who respond well to rewards, you know. So just on every level, she is, in such a short space of time, hitting all the points that she needs to hit in order to motivate her troops. And she goes on to say, I know already for your forwardness, you have deserved rewards and crowns, and we do assure you in the word of a prince, they shall be duly paid to you. And now this is a very kind of its time moment, because at that time, in fact, there weren't really standing armies in really anywhere in the world, actually. So soldiers weren't just soldiers, and so they were paid all the time for being soldiers. They would actually basically be called or conscripted up at the time. And so they would expect to get their rewards when they actually went into battle. Now, either that would be by being paid, or it would be by getting the spoils of war, you know, being able to, you know, I guess, take land and take grain and take whatever else you find. Now, of course, when you're defending the country, you're not going to get the spoils of war. So it was actually a very big deal to say, for a sovereign to say, I assure you, you will be paid. Now, this is actually my least favorite part of the speech, just because it kind of feels a bit pedestrian issue. And of course, you're going to be paid. Everybody, you know, on Friday, you'll get your pay slips, right? So this is actually the only part of the speech that I kind of just didn't really like. But, you know, she had to do it. So what am I going to say? I can't say she shouldn't do it. But let's move on. So she goes on, in the meantime, my lieutenant general shall be in my stead, than whom never prince commanded a more noble or worthy subject. Now, I need to explain a little bit about that, and then you'll see why it's such great leadership. So the lieutenant general that she refers to was actually a gentleman called Robert Dudley. Again, for those of you who've seen movies around that time, Robert Dudley was kind of her lover, on-off lover, certainly someone who was one of the courtiers of her and was known to have her favor, as it were. But he, in fact, had recently, about 3 years earlier, suffered a pretty bad loss or defeat in battle in the Netherlands. And so here what she's doing effectively is saying, okay, I'm actually not going to be the one fighting for you, but my general, my lieutenant general, will be here in my stead, in my place. And a prince never commanded a more noble or worthy subject. So she is saying, you're actually going to be under the command of this gentleman, Robert Dudley. I know some of you may be thinking about the fact that, oh, didn't this guy just lose a big battle? But me, as your queen, who you love and trust, I'm telling you that he is a noble and worthy subject. That is a leader lending her shine, as it were, to a deputy. That is excellent leadership. That is giving authority, or lending your authority, to someone who it is doubted about from the others. But by giving or lending it to him, she infuses him with kind of greater strength of leadership as well. And that is what leaders must do. You must build and grow other leaders. So it's just really clever and powerful stuff, all in a very short space of time. And she goes on to conclude, right? So I told you, it's a really short speech. She goes on to conclude, and not doubting, but by your obedience to my general, by your concord in the camp, and your valor in the field, we shall shortly have a famous victory over these enemies of God, of my kingdom, and of my people. And that's it. And she ends. Now, what does that last part mean? It basically saying that I know you're going to follow my lieutenant general, Robert Dudley. I know that you're such concord, you've got concord in the camp, so you're all comrades in arms and everything. And you're going to show valor, bravery in the field. And because of these things, we will shortly have a famous victory. And then she uses the rule of three again over those enemies of God, of my kingdom, and of my people. And she ends with my people, the same way she started, my loving people. So she kind of buttresses the whole speech at the beginning with my loving people and at the end with my people, saying, I am your queen, I am your sovereign, but I am with you. Even if I can't actually fight, you know that I have the heart and stomach of a king, and that's going to give you all the courage that you need. It is brilliant, brilliant stuff. I know I'm geeking out on this, guys, but this is the hallmark of great presentation, great public speaking, great leadership, and a great example of how to, in a very short space of time, basically 2 minutes, how to get your team, if you are a leader, ready to run into the fire for you, to fight and die. She used the simple approach of connecting, resonating with her troops so that they felt like they would do what they needed to do in order to secure victory. And even though, as I said, in fact, the battle never materialized, because in fact, it turned out that the Spanish were already sailing away, but they weren't to know that at the time. The speech, or the report of the speech, did the rounds throughout the country, and that helped to cement her authority, to cement her leadership. And she went on, of course, to rule for a very long time. This is 1588, and she ruled until, I think, 1603. I just had to check my note quickly. 1603. So she really, I mean, this came in the middle of her reign, but it really allowed her to just continue going. And a lot of times people talk about the golden age of England during her reign. So just a really, really good short speech. And I'd always planned to do a review of this speech. I think it's a great way to start off 2021. Because I kind of think we need to be inspired. You know, we've had such a bad run of, you know, in the world, just for many different things in 2020. And I think it really is the time for great leaders to step up and show us a better path, right? Inspire us, make us believe that despite the fact that things look bleak, somehow we are going to pull through. Somehow we're going to come through all this pain and this turmoil, and that you leaders are going to be there with us fighting to get things done right so that we can emerge and be victorious. That's kind of the theme that I would love to see in 2021. Ain't seen it yet, to be honest, if I look at some of the leaders that we have. So maybe one of them will listen to this podcast episode and revisit the speech of Queen Elizabeth I, the Tilbury speech, and maybe it will inspire them to lift their rhetoric up to meet the moment and the times that we are in. So there we go. That is my analysis of the Tilbury speech by Elizabeth I in 1588. What do you think? Let me know what you think by replying to emails, tweeting me, doing a review and telling me how good or how bad you thought my review was. And certainly feel free, a few people have been doing this actually, feel free to send me your thoughts on which speech I should analyze next. I have had a few recommendations already, which is really great, and I think I may well take some of them up as well. I certainly have in my mind some of the speeches I want to review, but this is good. So yeah, send in your thoughts or your recommendations of speeches you would like me to review. But in the meantime, I will leave you this week with Goodbye in Another Language. Again, some stuff I'd kind of stopped doing, which is very, very naughty of me. So this will be Ma Salam, which is Arabic for goodbye. I think I've probably slightly got that wrong, but I think I'm right. So goodbye, my great communicators. Thank you for sharing your time and your ears with me. I will see you in a little while with the next episode, which may be a speech review or maybe an interview. We'll see. All right. See you then.